If you're one of millions of Australians who recently downloaded the government application called MyGov to access government services on your phone, you would have noticed the use of facial recognition technology being used to identify you. The application had used voice recognition before, but now you can put your face to the camera and the application will scan your face to ensure you are you. Facial recognition technology is developing at record speeds, and it's mostly being used to identify us for our passports or for within crowds. But there's another form of facial technology which claims to move beyond identification, but in fact to scan our face and describe our characteristics or our emotions as well. And this type of technology is called facial analysis technology. But you're probably wondering why I'm talking about technology when this podcast is about history. The reason is because it's not a new idea. In fact, for well over a century, there were people who claimed to study faces and head shapes and offer insights beyond our names. It was called phrenology.
The phrenologist calls up people on stage. He or she might be blindfolded, for example, to really show that they're not basing their assessment on any kind of visual marker. They are just working with their hands and using their skill to read the shape of the head.
And it was delivered in many, many forms with some very dark implications. Today we walk through the seedy world of arcade phrenology in the 1920s. We meet one of Melbourne's most enduring phrenologists, infamous Russian mystic, Madame Gurka, and we speak to technology experts about computerised facial analysis. And we'll find out if it's any less deceptive than the highly controversial days of skull studying and make-believe. My name's Kate Follington, and you're listening to the podcast Look History in the Eye, produced by Public Record Office Victoria, the archive of the state government. 100 kilometres of public records are preserved in climate-controlled vaults. We meet the people who dig into those boxes, look history in the eye, and bother to wonder why. You can see records related to this story by searching Look History in the Eye podcast online. Phrenologists practice a now discredited form of popular science, and they claimed that character and your intellect could be judged from your head shape. This was in the 1800s and well into the 1900s. They covered a wide range of subject matter, and they would often deliver their findings to quite a public audience, kind of like in public lectures or on the streets of Melbourne, something like a busking performance.
Lady, my name is Tweedlepunch, Anthony Tweedlepunch, phrenologist and scientist. Make hand, if you please.
Now, my dear, we shall see whom nature intended you to marry.
I know already. Shall I answer? Is it fit?
Certainly. Do as Papa wishes you to, like a good little girl.
Certainly, my dear. Certainly, do as I tell you.
Now, please, lady, will you remove your hat?
Science ought to be above such trifles.
Science is above most trifles, but phrenology lies beneath the hat.
Well,
thank you so much.
What do you think of me?
There were black phrenologists, European mystics, and bellowing creative entertainers. They came in all shapes and sizes.
You might go along on an evening to the Mechanics Institute or perhaps the Athenaeum. You know, there were instances where people, you know, were climbing through windows and really trying to cram in because this is the talk of the town, and there might have been a bell ringer, handbills handed out that this lecturer is coming.
Dr. Alexandra Rogidsky has published her PhD, a whole book on Australian and New Zealand phrenologists and their influence on understandings of the mind and also of popular culture.
So depending on how earnest they are, they would, you might have a very long lecture about the different organs of the brain. And they talked about the brain being divided into different sections. That was the organs. And they would lecture at length on particular organs. They'd often talk about how persecuted they were as scientists and that this was the right, you know, the right and only true science and that kind of thing. So standard padding. Mm-hmm. And then you'd go into the public readings. And this was, in a sense, the great test of the phrenological skill. This is a time when scientific inquiry is quite participatory. So the audience feels that they're going to make up their own mind, right? They're going to watch this and they're part of the experience of deciding and validating the truth or falsity of this thing. So, you know, they call up, the phrenologist calls up people on stage. He or she might be blindfolded, for example, to really show that they're not basing their assessment on any kind of visual marker. They are just working with their hands and using their skill to read the shape of the head. And then they'll pronounce to the audience, this person is this or that. And the audience might cheer or laugh, or, you know, there's a great deal of laughter.
Yeah, it's a carnival.
Totally.
Gilfine, a charming tale. Affection stands out like a policeman's mitt, corroborated on the other side. And I see domesticity developed also. What a cook, yo-yo, what a cook, what a mutzen mixer.
It was devised as a system at the end of the 18th century by a Viennese physician, and he was quite serious about dissection. And part of this great period of inquiry into mind and brain and how it fit together, were we just the product of our brains, or were we also influenced by spiritual other forces? So it comes about in this time of neurological inquiry. It's really debated and contested, as a lot of ideas were. It also comes about at a time of interest in comparative anatomy, so human differences, those seen in Europe and people from, you know, encountering other parts of the world, questions about, you know, how deep do these differences go?
By the 1920s, the lecture hall entertainers were being upstaged by moving pictures, and the era of cinema was taking over. So street phrenology was pushed into other spaces, like the Eastern Arcade, on Exhibition Street, with its impressive Middle Eastern Moorish facade. The balconies were framed by pointed archways, similar to a mosque. It was an exotic escape for the young, where the fruits of Orientalism could be enjoyed for fun. It was designed to be alluring for leisure seekers and the curious.
It's tantalizing, it's different, and this is why a lot of the fortune tellers and phrenologists and various diviners in this space and in the Eastern Arcade were giving themselves made-up names that sounded exotic. So you might have someone called Annie Cartwright or Annie Stevens, who goes by the stage name of Zinger Lee, or
as you do,
yeah, Madame Zambra, Madame Zingara, these kind of sibilant names. These people sounding exotic, often wearing what they think of as gypsy costumes, gypsy dress. And it's a bit of a world of theatre and make-believe. It's various costumiers and dressmakers. There's dress-up, fancy dress hire. There's vaudeville artists. There's a wine shop because alcohol and coffee consumption was always part of this world as well. There's an Italian club, there's a spiritualistic seance hall, there's a herbalist, and my entry point into this is the phrenologist.
Fortune tellers offered a bit of everything, from women needing marriage advice to herbalist tonics for arthritis. And while they may have visited for the tarot card reading, the sign outside their shop fronts would say, phrenologist. Because fortune-telling was forbidden and phrenology was considered more legitimate.
Fortune-tellers were thought of as having power to tell people to leave their spouses, for example, to disrupt the social order. They were seen as having an influence that was, corrupting people at a time when there's a lot of concerns about working-class behaviour, about women's behaviour. Women facing a prosecution for, and this applied to vagrancy laws in general. So someone who you could be locked up for being on the street and not having an occupation, and that person would say, I do have an occupation, I'm a phrenologist, because it was something you could just assume and kind of do on the side. But these, women are generally saying, I'm not a fortune teller, I'm a phrenologist. That's a science. It's a very old science. If you don't understand that, then like you've got a lot of things going on.
It's hard to talk about phrenology in Melbourne without mentioning Madame Gurkha or Julia Glushkova. She upstaged them all. She was a character reader and Melbourne's most enduring and reputation at least phrenologist. Arriving in Australia at the end of the First World War in 1917, her infamy reached new heights when she was linked to a murder case that was still being heard within the Melbourne judicial system right up until recently.
She was actually a Russian migrant who earlier in her life was known as Julia Glushkova or Glushkova. And she seems to have been born in Odessa, but she was half Welsh and emigrated to Wales in 1882. And the circumstances surrounding that emigration, depending on the story she's telling, depending on the reporting, are that she had thrown a bomb at the horse and carriage of a local notable figure, and that this was in retribution for her brother dying. Whether or not this meant she was a revolutionary was something that she contested. But she leaves the country and goes to the UK to live with family relatives there. It's there that she gets married. She has a son called Alexander Olson, and a daughter called Violet. Her husband dies. She remarries a man called Henry Gibson. Henry Gibson's a vaudeville performer. They have four sons, and they end up in Australia at the end of the First World War. And she ends up with rooms in the Eastern Arcade. She is also a phrenologist and a character reader. Mm. Other people might say she's a palmist and a fortune teller.
Julia, aka Madame Gurkha, also claims in one newspaper report that she was shot when she was working as an agent for the British Secret Service. She still says that she managed to kill the son of a Russian war general on one of her missions. But this claim is fiercely denied by her own husband, who admits to accidentally shooting her during a circus performance in Russia.
She's also accused at a certain point of being an abortionist, which is a matter she sues over. One thing you can definitely say is she's very canny. I think it's really worth noting that in 1918, her husband, Henry Gibson, he wants her to give up her business and move with him to the country. Pretty classic abuse dynamic. He comes and he smashes up her shop display cases in her shop. She brings this civil case against him and he's basically ordered to stay away from her.
By 1921, Madame Gurkha finds herself a single mother of four children running businesses which might get her arrested. But regardless, fortune-telling or phrenology in all its various forms is worth the risk. She's even renting out a flat to Ivy Matthews, a woman who's working the wine bar in the arcade. The wine bar is owned by a man called Colin Ross, and it's called the Australian Wine Saloon. But the bar is not liked by the other retailers because it's attracting a type of clientele who urinate on the floor and verbally abuse people coming into the arcade. So it's fair to say that the bar owner, Colin Ross, wasn't liked by Ivy Matthews or Madame Gurkha. And eventually Ivy is fired. And this is where things get really messed up. It's 1921 and the two of them seize upon an opportunity to help frame Ross. It's a really sad case, which ends up haunting Madame Gurkha and the Melbourne judicial system for another century. It's the murder case of 12-year-old Alma Tichka, otherwise known as the Gun Alley Murder.
On the 30th of December 1921, is sent by her grandmother from the grandmother's home in Jolimont to pick up some meat from the city. And she goes to the butcher. She's seen wearing a distinctive blue skirt and white blouse and has ribbons. And she ends up around the location of the Eastern Arcade, seen with her brown parcel. and various people see her. She doesn't come home that night, and the next morning she's found, her body is found in Gun Alley, which is a small laneway off Little Collins Street, very close to the Eastern Arcade. This murder is very shocking. It really shakes up the city. There's a lot of speculation about who it might be. And the police end up arresting Ross and prosecuting him. And the evidence really hinges on the testimony of three people, one of whom is Ivy Matthews, another is a sex worker called Olive Maddox, who is also associated with that place and knows Ross, and the other is a man awaiting trial in jail who claims that Ross, when he's on remand, makes this confession to him in very lurid and awful details. So they're claiming that Ross confessed to the crime, that it was part of a pattern, that he had pedophilic tendencies, basically. That testimony, together with hair sampling, so this is an early instance of hair sampling used in a forensic context, is used to convict him. But there's a very strong case made by the barrister. He publishes a book about this, that Ross has been wrongly convicted.
Colin Ross is found guilty by jury, is then hung in April 1922. The case is closely followed by the media, in particular the Herald, who also offer a financial reward to solve the crime. And then that reward is then shared among, Madame Gurkha and Ivy Matthews, along with other Crown witnesses, many of whom were even staying at Madame Gurkha's home during the trial. If you are interested in this case, there are several detailed books and newspaper articles written about it, and you can find those at the State Library of Victoria, along with the court files, which you can find here at Public Record Office Victoria, many of which are digitised. There is a silver lining to this story, and that is that Ross is eventually proven to be innocent.
But in the late 1990s, the hair samples, which were in the records from the Ross case, they're taken to the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine and they're sampled. And these are not the same hairs. So the hairs that were snipped from the head of Alma Tichka are not the same hairs as those that are found on these blankets that had been in Ross's possession.
So he's ultimately exonerated.
He is. Posthumously. Yeah. And that it does cast the role of this network of people who testify in this case that contribute to his conviction, and Madame Gurkha as one of the puppet masters within that group, in a very different light.
So while we have on the one hand, on the very fringes, phrenologists and palm readers working in the seedy underbelly of the arcades, at the same time there's also a more palatable, if not equally insidious, form of phrenology emerging within the middle classes in the early 1900s. And this form of phrenology then contributes to a conversation about what makes the ideal Australian. And during the early 1900s, that person was a white male born on Australian soil.
There's a shift during the 19th century from what is known as an environmentalist approach, which says that, you know, where we look different because of the environments that we live in, but actually we're one community of man, to this much more kind of fixed idea that develops and gains traction during the 19th century about racial difference, and that racial difference is physical, but it also has, you know, it's signs of things inside, it's signs of mental capacity.
The long-term legacy of phrenology, the pseudoscience, you might say, is that it overlaps and is commonly associated with eugenics. Those phrenologists who attempted to idealise white European heads over any other cultural ancestry, describing them as inferior due to their head shape.
And so phrenology does become also a form of racial science, very importantly. This is why we have skull collections collected by phrenologists that include Australian Aboriginal ancestral remains, for example, those of other people. In America, it was used very much in thinking about people of African heritage as well. So it has those darker connotations. We've also got the social reformers, what we would think of as the smaller liberals of the day, the progressives. So in the early 19th century, there's a group established at the Athenaeum. They're called the Phrenological and Health Institute of Australasia. They have a magazine called Mind and Body. The people who are pulling the levers in the Phrenological and Health Institute are middle-class women involved with the Women's Christian Temperance Union. They see phrenology as playing a role for social improvement in terms of guiding people to behave in the right way.
I should add here that their organisational photo is similar to any early 20th century sepia-toned group photo of conservative-looking women, neatly dressed, with long skirts and blouses pinned to the neck, their long hair pulled up into a neat bun, standing among well-manicured men with neat moustaches and three-piece suits and polished shoes, except for one thing. They're holding human skulls in their hands, like some weird gothic dress-up party.
Also a link to the White Australia idea?
Yes, there is a very, like, there's a deep undercurrent of white supremacy in all of this, often unspoken. But if you look at who the focus is on for improvement, it is a concern about the white race. It's a concern about who are Australians, how can we make them as strong and robust as possible, and a concern with organising society in a way that produces the best stock.
By the late 1920s, phrenology begins its decline as psychoanalysis is gaining steam. Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, they're presenting their groundbreaking ideas of the study of psychoanalysis, and this idea that we're influenced by our past and that we have a subconscious mind. Phrenologists begin to rebadge themselves as psychologists, and they begin to use more elaborate language, psychoanalytical language, in their readings. What is our life force? Are we introverted? Are we extroverted? Do we fit into Jung's eight archetypes? Amazingly, phrenologists continue to operate in Australia right up until the 1960s. Mostly employed by large businesses to assist in their recruitment processes or to offer vocational advice on behalf of parents, like Graham, who was sent by his parents in 1957 as a 16-year-old along to Hayward Masters for a head reading.
He said I had three main abilities, a good eye, good constructive ability, look at things from a practical point of view, and a profit-making sense. And he went on from there, I suppose, but influenced by the fact that he did suggest that I take up public speaking to give me better use of words and give me confidence. I lacked confidence. Yes, he suggested by going from my career from banking, I must have mentioned architecture to him because I don't remember him asking me many questions about myself, except my name, address, how old I was, and I must have mentioned, he probably asked me what I wanted to do for a living, really, if I left the bank. I said I wanted to be an architect. I had top skill in technical tech drawing. But my maths one and two were a bit weak.
Rather than the head reading, perhaps it was the confidence that he gave to you, the belief in you as a person.
I think so. He also suggested I take up, I lack self-confidence, and I should take up playing competitive sport to develop a keener attack, which I did. I joined a golf club, for example.
Graham is not alone in feeling a positive impact from personal analysis. Let's face it, many people feel
that personality surveys provide some worthy conversation starters, regardless of the credibility of the science behind the analysis. Sometimes it's just a spark you need to motivate some change. And I think it's fair to say that it was a guiding hand that Graham needed, not a head study. Believe it or not, but during the 1960s, top executives from Australia were going along to see phrenologists and even sending their wives along for advice on how to be a good executive wife.
These days, Mrs. Burton has the table set at 10 o'clock in the morning for tonight's dinner party. But there was a time when she didn't manage so well, and her husband suggested she should do something to become a better executive wife.
Yes, as a matter of fact, he had done something himself about being a better executive, and he'd gone to a phrenologist. A phrenologist is a person that puts his hands through your hair, feels your bumps, and then sits back and enjoys conversation with you, and then helps you adjust your way of thinking.
So your husband suggested that you should
go. So he suggested maybe I'd like to do this because other executives' wives had more or less had an inspection from this person.
And we are now well into the 21st century, and there is a new phrenologist in town. This time, the hands that feel our heads to draw conclusions are touchless. They're analysing our faces with screen-based cameras and spitting out their findings based on mass data sets. And while we sit at the very early stages of artificial intelligence and machine learning, there is emerging a new form of technological deception, akin to the phrenologist of the past. And this is why governments are seeking regulatory guidance on how to ensure that computers and their machine learning software don't begin to promise insights beyond identification and claim things about our character or emotional states which are simply untrue.
There's a lot of experimentation that has been done on other forms of facial analysis. Perhaps one of the most infamous examples of that was a team of researchers in the United States at Stanford University, who did this really controversial experiment where they took a large number of photographs from a dating app, Grindr, which is particularly used by people in the LGBT community. And what they tried to kind of use a machine learning algorithm to do was to identify the characteristics associated with people who might be, say, gay or lesbian. And then when a new photo was put before the machine, it was asked, you know, is this person likely to be gay or lesbian? And that's a really concerning example. Yes, that was done in an experimental scenario. It wasn't being done, as we understand it, to, you know, make decisions that would affect people's legal rights. But nevertheless, if that sort of application were to get into the wrong hands, we would be really worried. One, just incredibly sensitive information. Two, the system didn't work very well. The idea that someone's sexual orientation would be revealed by something about their facial structure, I mean, that is the very kind of essence of phrenology. The science behind that is just plain wrong.
That's Professor Edward Santo. He's the co-director of the University of Technology Sydney's Human Technology Institute. His team are working on identifying the gaps where legislation is not sufficient to control how technology may be used to analyse us as people and identify us and influence decision-making.
But the thing that is most impressive about machine learning is that it will pick up the patterns in the data. It will pick up the sort of characteristics associated with apples, you know, the sort of colours, the texture, the little stalk, that sort of thing. And it will also pick up the characteristics, the patterns in the data associated with oranges. And so over time, if you show the machine a new picture of an apple or an orange, one that it's never seen before, it should be able to look for those patterns and then be able to correctly identify whether it's an apple or an orange. So that's the idea behind all machine learning-based image recognition. So the thing about facial analysis is that it relies on exactly that technique. So let's say what you are trying to do is use facial analysis to determine whether someone is responsible or not. Mm-hmm. The original sin starts with the labelling, because you still have to give it a whole bunch of pictures of people who are
responsible,
labelled either responsible or irresponsible. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you can do that. Maybe you could maybe say, look, you know, the category of people that you want to describe as irresponsible is people, you know, photos of people who've been, you know, sentenced to prison for 10 years or more for, you know, terrible crimes, right? So maybe that is the very definition of an irresponsible person. And the, you know, the training data for people who are responsible might be people, you know, who have been, you know, awarded prizes for doing the right thing, right? So let's just say, like, it'd be very difficult, but let's just say, you know, for the sake of argument, you could get photos, very large number of photos of people in those two categories. But I just do want to emphasize that would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible. Mm. But secondly, there's a really basic problem here, which is what makes someone responsible or irresponsible has nothing to do with their face. Yeah. Someone is not more responsible because of the size of their nose or the placement of their ears or anything like that. Those things are just don't reveal anything about your level of responsibility. And so the problem is that the machine will still find patterns in the data, right? But they're meaningless.
Unfortunately, at this point, there is no obligation for companies to disclose the modelling data that they're feeding into the machines. What photos, what labels are marked against what data to produce patterns and then produce analysis? And this is concerning, particularly when the research they're using to train the software is historically problematic, or that permissions to utilise data about us haven't been correctly sought. Christopher O'Neill is part of a research team from the Australian Research Centre of Excellence on Automated Decision Making. He acknowledges that facial analysis technology is still on the fringes. It's being used more in America than it is here. But there's some concerning data, particularly data linking facial expressions to emotional states.
So emotion detection algorithms, they're mostly predicated upon the work of a psychologist, Paul Ekman, who's an American psychologist working in the, from the 50s and 60s. He was employed by DARPA, which is the big defense research institute in America, and basically they were asking him to try and work out a universal template for emotions, and he conducted what is now considered generally very dubious research. He went to Papua New Guinea, sort of thinking that people who lived in Papua New Guinea was sort of in a kind of living closer to nature, and so they were kind of closer to like pure emotion than we were in Australia or in America in the West, you know. And so he was kind of using images of these people to try and sort of detect or try and sort of define sort of pure emotional states. Like, this is what a purely happy face looks like, a purely sad face, a purely angry face. And these are basically been used as the templates for trying to determine, you know, what a particular emotion looks like. Yeah. Mm. Now, it rests upon an extremely dubious idea. One, that there is such a thing as a pure emotional state that is universal. The idea that I feel happy in the same way you feel happy, in the same way that anybody in the world might feel happy. And also the idea that there's a universal, you know, language of the face that we might use to express that happiness or anger or stress or whatever. You know, the way we express emotion is highly culturally specific. It's determined by social norms and that kind of thing. The idea that there's a one-to-one relation between the way I feel or the way I am and the way my face looks is also, you know, basically pseudoscientific, you know. Mm. So Ekman kind of took these kind of core models of, what a particular emotion looks like on the face, and then he took that back to the lab and got grad students to sort of, you know, he'd say, okay, do a happy face, do a stressed face, do an angry face. and they would sort of perform. But you know, it was sort of highly performative already. They were sort of doing an impression of a happy face. And he would say, yes, great, that's happy, that's happy, that's happy. That doesn't look quite happy enough for me. And this was how they sort of collected the initial data set that these models afterwards have been trained on, been used to label facial detection algorithms. And the detection of emotion is highly culturally specific, it's highly racialized, highly gendered. There's been studies that have been done of emotion detection algorithms that have found they tend to classify, for example, African-American people, you know, tend to look angrier according to these algorithms than white people do. And so there's a kind of inbuilt sort of the sort of central presupposition of the models wrong, but they sort of reinforce or racial bias. And this is obviously a huge problem in terms of if they get used in job interviews.
And this is the interesting part about human beings. Why do we seek out deception? Why don't we trust our own intuition? Are we so afraid of being wrong that we would rather blame a machine? We would rather be willingly deceived because the responsibility of the decision is then placed onto the shoulders of a machine or a fortune teller? We would rather do that than experience the discomfort of a poor decision, than embrace the natural chaos of the occasional win and the occasional fail.
You know, generally speaking, if companies buy these, they're sort of told that these algorithms are reliable, to sort of, even if they're sort of spitting out data that seems like, oh, I don't know, I had a bad feeling about this guy, or this guy doesn't, you know, he doesn't seem that happy to me, you know, I mean, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah.
Or he interviewed really badly, and I had a bad feeling about him, but the algorithm is saying he's a wonderful person. There's not necessarily any easy way to question these algorithms.
I guess it comes down to this idea that we would trust data over our own intuition.
Yeah, there's a term in the literature called automation bias, which people tend to trust automated systems more than they trust their own judgment.
Phrenology and any form of insight offered from reading our faces or our heads was deceptive a century ago and is still deceptive today, regardless of whether a computer is making that analysis or Zinger Lee.
You can trace back to sort of phrenology of the idea that the face is a sort of universal signifier, that it's true everywhere all the time, that you can, you know, in across cultures and across environments and so forth. But in practice, the face is actually very unstable, bears the marker of culture, of society, and of environmental determinants in ways that can be, you know, quite strange and quite difficult to predict ahead of time.
You've been listening to Look History in the Eye, produced by Public Record Office Victoria. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends. And if you are interested in the original records that motivated this episode, you can go to the website. Just type in Look History in the Eye podcast online.